Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. I also wanted to say that today's episode is sponsored by my book. I have a book coming out. I'm so proud of this, guys. The links are already up. I'll have them in the show notes. But the book is called Modern Still Life, From Fruit Bowls to Disco Balls. It is my take on a step-by-step painting book. I am really excited about it. Not only does it have like motivational tips and tricks to keep you going in your practice, but it also has clear and beautiful and full color breakdowns of the step-by-step process in my paintings. So I could not be more excited about it. If you wanted to check it out, pre-order it. It would help me more than you even know. Hey y'all, welcome back to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is about embracing the messiness of art making and the surprising power of bad art. This episode was inspired in part by a conversation I had with a student on the very last day of the France painting retreat. I find that often the most enriching, deep conversations happen on those last days, and some of the biggest breakthroughs happen. And it was one of those moments that I wanted to share here. But I'm gonna start this episode off with a story of one of my children and how it's one of those like family stories that never stops making me giggle. So while we're protecting a certain amount of anonymity, I'm going to share that story with you and what we can sort of glean from that story and implement into our art. And then finally, at the end of the episode, I'm going to talk to you about how to manage that bad art. Do you share it? Do you hide it? I have some thoughts and insights because I don't ever want to just leave you guys with make bad art, it's okay. And you know, there's a certain amount of rawness and vulnerability to making that art. So from artist to artist, I'll tell you how I deal with my frequent bad art. The last thing I'll mention in this intro is it seems like a lot of my episodes really more or less talk about perfectionism. And I almost didn't record this episode because I didn't want it to feel redundant. But the thing is, perfectionism is a hard nut to crack. It's tough because it's like when you have an addiction to something that you need to survive, you know, whatever that is, where it's like you can't completely get rid of it. Because in art making, you have to have like an inner curator. I prefer to probably, you know, change the name of that away from a perfectionist and more towards you do, in order to have taste, have to have a part of yourself that is discerning, that can look at what you've made from multiple different viewpoints and sort of judge it accordingly so that you can change and grow as an artist. And also so you can know when and where to share your artwork. I think those insights are really valuable in the sign of someone who has a certain amount of intelligence and awareness. And because of that complexity, I think it's worth coming at a bunch of different points of view. So I'm really excited about this episode. Let's just jump in. Okay, so I'm going to start with the little family story. One of my children was learning how to ride a scooter, and in the little town I live in, just outside of Austin, the roads are horrific. I mean, truly, they're pothole central. We have like trees growing in the middle of our roads. It's, you know, it's Texas, so we, you know, don't love paying taxes here, I suppose. And one of the outcomes is that our roads are, I honestly think it might be better if it was a gravel road sometimes. But anyways, I'm giving you this insight because it's even hard to kind of run on these roads. And we had been practicing in the driveway. And a thing to know about this particular kid is that they're very cautious. This is a kind of kid who I would take to the park when they were pretty little. And I have had other kids and I've watched nieces and nephews. This kid's personality is an anomaly. Very cautious, very safe, very discerning, you know, sensitive kid. And they're really excited to learn to ride the scooter. And on our controlled, smooth pavement, they did a pretty good job. They eased into it. It took months to sort of get comfortable with it. And one day we decided, let's ride this scooter to the park, which is about a quarter of a mile away from our house. And I should also say that at this point, this kid had fallen down one time while practicing learning how to ride a scooter in our very smooth driveway. And it was sad, and there were boo-hoos, and you know, very dramatic. It's, you know, kids are kids. I don't know, no judgment here, but just It was a moment. We worked through it. That we had tears, Band-Aids, and nothing a red popsicle can't fix. Anyways, so this is a day or two or a few later. I can't quite remember. And we had made it almost all the way to the park. Again, this kid probably could have walked faster, but slow, discerning. And they hit a bump and fell over. And it was really sad. I laugh now. In the moment, it was very sad. And the knee was scratched up and there were tears. But the first thing they said when they fell was, "Not again." And this is where there's this humor, because I think the expected response would be, "Oh no," or, you know, maybe even a age appropriate profanity of some kind. But I just remember after we made sure they were okay, my husband and I cracking up, because "not again" just felt so silly. And it's funny because, like, you don't know in the moment why it's so silly. It just felt like, I don't know, just like out of place for their little body and this, like, you know, very dramatic reaction to it. But, you know, in years since, because it's kind of become family lore to, if you make a mistake, you kind of have this big dramatic "not again" moment, I realized that the humor in it is, of course, you're going to keep falling down. You're learning how to ride a scooter and you're doing something new and you're on a bumpy road. And, you know, especially when you're little, you're learning to walk, anything, you fall a lot. Like, even this, like, very careful, cautious kid, like, you know, scraped up knees, they just happen. It's part of it. It's not that you avoid it. I think the "not again" is funny because when you're learning to do something physical and you're little, like, falling just kind of comes with it. It's part of the territory. Whether you completely wipe out and scratch your knees or you sort of fumble and save yourself, you know, you're trying to do a new activity. And I think for a kid to sort of have, like, the insight to assume that they could get around it with this declarative statement of, like, "not again," just kind of cracks me up. And, you know, I think about it how a lot of times artists, especially, I will say, like, artists who are, like, adults, and maybe they've been branded as, like, good at art. They're good at drawing, they're good at color, they're creative. And there's this mentality of, like, okay, I can make, like, one bad painting, but if I make another, like, you know, they have their own sort of metaphorical or perhaps even literal "not again" moments. And I would love if we, like, we had as much humor about that. The humor, of course, coming from the fact that, of course, you're going to make mistakes. "Not again" is so dramatic because there's no scenario where mistakes aren't completely part of the process. And I will say, as a testament to mistake making, you know, someone being good at a skill, whether it's art or, let's say, it's, you know, professional X scootering, right? I think that's the thing, right? Like, BMX style scootering. I don't know, maybe I'm showing my age of being, you know, a child in the early 2000s, but, you know, someone who does that at a somewhat professional level, or skateboards or inline skates or whatever, the mark of being good at that skill is not that in practice you avoid falling down. I would assume that some of the skill is you learn how to fall down, but rather as your skill improves and as the risks you take become larger and more impressive, your falls are always going to stay at a certain ratio that's reflective of your own unique process, skills, and abilities. And what I would like to sort of impart is, like, to nurture a part of yourself that when you do have that sort of catastrophizing moment of, like, oh, not another ugly painting or terrible portrait or painting that didn't come together, and is heartbreaking, and is, like, you know, I don't want to invalidate that, just like I didn't invalidate my kid. We cried and boo-hooed and had a talk about how you're gonna fall when you're learning something new and we'll always take care of you. I think learning to approach a perspective in which you make art and avoid mistakes should be approached with as much humor because of how wild of a thought it is to make art without making lots and lots of mistakes and bad art. I wanted to bring this around to an absolutely beautiful, deep and emotional conversation I had on the last day of the painting retreat in France with a student. There was a few of us kind of around painting and listening and talking, but it was really kind of more in the spirit of a one-on-one, with the student being incredibly vulnerable and sharing a bit of their heart and their struggle. For context, the student is incredibly skilled. They are, like, one of, maybe if not the, definitely one of the best drafts people, as in they're really good at drawing. And their aspiration is to work in children's literature, which is beautiful. And this person certainly has the skill and the talent and the drive to do so. But we were talking about how they feel almost like stunted because of this desire to make perfect art, and how so much of their identity is wrapped up in being a good artist. And that happens, like, especially if like you're good at drawing for some reason. I don't know if anyone relates to this, but it's like in second, third, fourth grade, there's this day where sort of everyone, all of a sudden they go from looking at their own work and kind of being engrossed in it to like, you kind of look around at everyone else and you compare, and who's the best and who's the worst. And remember, we're talking about grade schoolers here. And so the metric of like, quote, good work is who is the best at drawing realistically, which in the grand scheme of art and creativity is such a small scope. And I think it's such unfortunate that we collectively don't push against that. There's no one in particular to blame. I think it's just something that happens. But I mean, always probably better arts education, in my humble opinion. And then you're sort of branded the art kid or not. And I feel like in some ways, obviously, the most obvious people that it hurts are the people who are very creative, very artistic, but maybe their hand-eye skill didn't develop as fast as everyone else, or maybe never that would have been their strength, but they're creative and good at color and insightful. And because they weren't branded the art kid in grade school, they never considered themselves the artist. And I think that's incredibly unfortunate. And I think on the other hand, it can be maybe sometimes even as dangerous is the kids who sort of get branded as the art kid. And then they, so much of who they are and their identity, especially when you're young, is like, I have to be good at this. And it sounds serious, but it's often things like bubble letters and, you know, who's best at drawing a horse. And, you know, it's, again, it's, we're allowing these really like childish visions of who's good and who's bad to steer us. And I'm saying this from my own personal, as someone who was branded kind of the artsy kid. You know, you get really caught up in your personality, and I think it takes a really self-possessed kid to not allow that to steer the ship a little bit. So again, this person sort of self-identified as like, that was my thing. Like, I was the art kid, and it's really important to who I am as a person. And we got to talking, because I feel a lot of this myself, and a lot of people in the room really resonated with this, but there's this idea that when you make bad work, you sort of lose that. And I think if we could sort of use my analogy at the beginning of like a child learning to ride a scooter and sort of like the silliness of thinking that you're not going to end up making bad art every once in a while. And I would say, especially within the context of like going with an artist to a whole other country and learning to paint in their style. Like in my workshops, there's a lot of room for, you know, individuality. And I sort of show you my way of painting and you can paint however you want to paint. I'm pretty open about that kind of thing. But, you know, even then, like you still, most people want to sort of paint in the way that I'm demoing, in the way I'm showing. And you have to acknowledge that that's really someone putting themselves out of their comfort zone. And to judge yourself and assume that you aren't going to, you know, metaphorically fall down or make, quote, bad art is, you know, I struggle to find the right word. I just think it's unkind. You know, I think of myself as a mom in the instance where my kid fell down. And had I sort of backed them up and said, yeah, how dare you fall again? Like, that is a cruel thing to do. And we have to remember, like, and I've said this in previous episodes about how I use reparenting tools in my own practice to help myself struggle with my own perfectionism, that we have to be a good, kind, compassionate, you know, person, parent to ourselves in how we respond to bad artwork. You know, I always think of it like, you can't let the perfectionist in you. And I would argue that it's more conducive to say like your inner critic or your inner curator. They have a purpose. They have a place. They cannot steer the ship, and they certainly can't be in charge of HR, you know? And I think there's a time and a place for that level of curation. I don't think you become skilled and talented without that in you a little bit. You know, I don't want to say that if you have sort of this rigid part of yourself, you'll never get over that and you won't be a good artist. It's more that the skill you need to develop is knowing when and where to let that voice take over. I think it's when you're deciding what to post on social media. I think it's when you're putting together your portfolio. I think it's when you're discerning who you want to take a workshop with. Who do you want to learn from? Who do you want to do a master study? let that part of you that's discerning, that does sit and weigh the minutia and the small things and is, you know, a reflective of your taste, make those choices. And in the meantime, don't let that part of yourself run the workshop. Don't let them come into the factory while you're making work, you know? Be more compassionate to yourself in those times and allow yourself to make the bad art. And the last thing I'll say on this before I talk about, you know, how to sort of consider this when publishing your artwork is there's this conversation about, okay, well, what constitutes bad art? And I'll say, like, I've been sort of workshopping iterations of this idea for years. I remember there was like a season where I was doing a lot of podcast interviews and, you know, they would ask me a lot of times it had to do with like my social media. It's like, wow, you have a, you know, social media, tell us all the tips and tricks. And, you know, some of the more kinder hosts would allow me to meander it back to, you know, the importance of like consistency. And I think if you talk about consistency, you're going to end up talking about perfectionism. And it's funny because that's not just a scary thing. Like other people knowingly or unknowingly understand that perfectionism and consistency are concepts that can tend to be antithetical if we're not more careful in how we sort of allow our inner perfectionist, our inner critic to engage and be a part of our art making process. And I like to position it like that because they are part of the process, but again, they're not leading the ship. They're not in charge of morale. They're not, you know, the manager of the production line. They have a spot, they have a little office high up on the production floor, and they take naps and they look, go to museums and they consume art media. And then you call them down when something is about to go out to the public. That, I mean, in my opinion, that's how that conversation should be. But anyways, and when people would ask me, you know, about, you know, what do you mean by like making bad art? Sometimes people would say, oh, well, it's not bad art or it's relative. And I think that there's a conversation there. It could certainly be its own podcast episode. I'll say that. The reason I'm so emboldened just saying bad art is because I don't know that the entire victory of coming to peace with what you make is about reframing your bad art as like helpful or stepping stones. Like certainly that can be a way you view it. And I'm sure I've said as much in the past, but I also think that there's a certain people, Virgos, no, I'm just kidding. There are certain people who you'll never win that fight if you just say, oh, it's not bad art. It's just, you know, different, or it's a little more expressive. Like I know that there are some people where that conversation is going to have traction, but I think I'm married to someone who that would never fly with. And so I always want to save space for, well, what if it is bad? What if it's not up to your standard? And if someone else made it, maybe you'd be compassionate and kind towards it. But for some reason, when you make it, you're not compassionate. I think it's okay as a starting point to say, yep, sometimes you do make bad art and it's important. And that's why I don't belabor that point. Okay. The last thing I want to talk about is, you know, I suppose getting back to the analogy of your inner critic being an aspect of your creative process. I want to talk about a theory of that I've been cooking for a while, which is generally speaking, there's two kinds of approaches to sharing our art. And it's, you know me, it is a rock and roll music analogy. One of my favorite songwriting duos is John Lennon and Paul McCartney of the Beatles. I love them. I know they were my first, like, I think one of my big deep dive music loves. I think I was like in middle school when I think I got one of those Beatles One albums from like the library, and I was like hooked, and I went through their whole discography and, you know, deep fandom. And I, you know, individually, I've gone through all of their, yes, even Ringo, you know, lightly on Ringo, but all of their discography, and really enjoy all their solo work. You know, I would consider myself musically, as far as their music, a huge fan. But, you know, the more you sort of look into the John Lennon versus Paul McCartney lore, their songwriting style and their publication style, there's this spin on the internet I've seen, and I've certainly witnessed it to some degree in my own research of them, that Paul McCartney really, you know, is the kind of musician who shares everything, puts out an enormous amount of artwork, musical work rather, and they're not all up to snuff. You know, there seems to be a lower threshold of curation in his work. And I will say some of those things that come out that are initially panned is like completely awful And like I've read articles written at the time of like, it's going to tarnish his image. It's really, man, you want to get a good perspective on like perfectionism and art making and how it's viewed by the public. Go back and read Rolling Stone articles from like 1983. Not everyone's take and not every time the way art is sort of interpreted in the present moment, does it always pan out? And I think that that should be really hopeful for us as artists that, you know, sometimes we're making art for a wider audience. And I don't know, again, that could totally be its own episode. But what I'll say is, like, for example, Temporary Secretary, it's a very controversial song. I couldn't stand it. And now I think it's just been an earworm long enough that like it's starting to feel like a part of my brain, like a little hallway in my brain just constantly has Temporary Secretary on. And I've warmed up to it. And so, and I've also, because of this, I've read and seen on like YouTube essays, people talk about how, you know, this was like the first EDM, you know, mainstream interpretation of an EDM track. And it went on to inspire people, you know, same with the album Ram. I remember there was an essay years ago, I think on YouTube, of someone saying that Ram was like the first indie album. I loved Ram, you know, a little before that, I think I really fell in love with that album. And there are always songs on McCartney albums that are just like the highs and lows. There's a lot of, in the sense of like what's panned universally as like very good, solid music and what is perhaps looked at as like very bad music, a lot of contrast in his work. Lots of highs, lots of lows, and he puts it all out. And I think a lot of when I've listened and read his interviews, you know, he's really saying like, this was music about this time and it's the good and the bad. You know, he doesn't call his own work bad, but he lets it all out there. And he's incredibly prolific. He also has done spin-off acts, you know, The Fireman, I believe, was one of them, where he allowed himself to make this more experimental music under a different name. And as someone who has my own very robust creative practice, I understand that, because there's always this like cultural fear of like tarnishing your reputation, that the risk of making bad artwork is that it can undo to some degree the success that you've made in the past. And wow, like what a scary non-productive threshold. And I see one of the ways that he coped with this by allowing himself these sort of pseudonyms and alter acts as a way to continue to make experimental work, put it out there, and sort of appease the conversations around tarnishing his, you know, the shine of being one of the leading members of this incredibly, you know, famous and highly revered band, which was the Beatles. And, you know, on the other hand, we have a John Lennon. Now, I will admit here in this analogy that I would say that Paul McCartney is maybe the gold standard of someone who has very intentionally subdued the inner curator, the inner tastemaker, the inner perfectionist, the inner critique, whatever you want to call it, and trusts a certain amount of like what will land, and maybe I'll just metaphorically say like turn down the volume on that. Not to say he doesn't have that. I'm sure. I can't imagine making music, picking what goes on an album and sending it out into the world. That feels so scary and intense. But I feel like he's like an A+ example of that. Now, John Lennon, on the other hand, I don't think is an A+ example of the other extreme, but he does, I think, certainly fall into that camp of someone who I think has a higher volume on their inner critic, their inner perfectionist. So is that John Lennon, you know, used to be one of the voices who sort of critiqued Paul McCartney in his like more prolific eras where he was beginning to be more experimental. Of course, it was interesting because later, like decades later, he would kind of retract some of those and say that Paul was a genius and he really admired his work and he admired his creativity. So, you know, take it as you will. But, you know, John Lennon would go, you know, sometimes very long, like 7-year spans without putting out any music. And of course, we know because Yoko Ono, especially after his untimely death in 1980 or 81, I can't quite remember, Yoko Ono, you know, did a lot of work going through the archives. She herself was a, you know, a visual artist as well as a musician, and would go back and went through his notes. I think he was beginning to record an album to come back. I do believe she worked with producers to help create kind of his final album, which, by the way, very good, very good album. I believe it was Milk and Honey, if I'm not mistaken. Anyways, all that to say. And so they were able to see that he had a pretty robust creative practice, you know, for the years leading up to his death and his own anticipated re-release of music. So he was intentionally making music to release. But I think what it gives us insight to is, you know, he had a process that was, his inner critic was maybe like in a closer office, part of the, you know, production, or at least had a louder voice, the volume turned all the way up in some aspect. And I'm presenting these both to you guys as like complete neutrals. Like there's not one that is better or worse, but rather to sort of remind you that if you develop a practice in which you do make bad art regularly, or whatever we're going to call it, work that isn't quite up to stuff, that's important and integral to your process, that moves the needle forward on what you're trying to create and what you're trying to communicate with your artwork, but for whatever reason, you don't know that you want it to be seen. I want to remind you that you have control over curation. In fact, that's when I work with artists, whether it's mentoring or on these retreats or workshops, it's something I remind them regularly, that like, allow yourself to make what you make and sit with it. And you would be amazed at the magic of, make a body of work, maybe dedicate 4 or 5 months to making work judgment-free, develop that practice, be okay with bad art, however you individually get you to making more art. And then when you're done with it, face it against a wall, let it collect, maybe take some time off, maybe don't. I don't know. We're all unique and individual. All of our timelines are cosmic and random, and that's fine. But take a moment at the end to invite that inner critic, the person who goes to the museums, who looks at the art, who has that taste, who's got that pointed goal and intention with their vision, and allow them in on the process. What do we like here? What do we not? And I would say that for me, that like that's a much more harmonious way. And what I've seen from my students is it's a much more productive way to engage in the art making. You know, I always want to be careful because like the Paul McCartney version of this creative process is going to be, I think, more compassionate in some ways, but it's also going to lend itself to capitalist sort of timelines in some ways. That 40-hour week, you got to post everything every single day sort of mentality. And I think if you're not doing that from a place of your own peace and relationship with your inner critic and I need to, quote, feed the beast of social media, you know, you do run into a place where you're sharing work that you're not comfortable with yet. You're not healed enough to share, whatever that looks like for you. And it could be more harm than good. You know, you could, I think, creatively overextend yourself. And in that instance, like maybe having a practice where you take a year off and then you make work and then you sort of follow maybe the musician's guide of like coming out with like an album every year or two, you know, or sometimes I think of artists as like seasonal birds that like migrate south to Mexico for the winter and they're back up in the Midwest in the summer. And like maybe, you know, certain times of year you don't make anything. You just you feed your taste and you relax, and then you all in a fury make a bunch of art in the winter, or vice versa, or whatever, you know. I'll leave with this. I think sometimes the advice of like just ignore your inner critic, just make art with reckless abandon, I think it's beautiful. And I think to anyone who that has been a breakthrough thought process for, I honor that. I think it's valuable. I know that for me, that is part of my own story and creative lineage. But I also want to sort of allow people who that feels like an empty, hollow platitude, that feels like an unreachable goal to them, to invite other ways of engaging with their more curated part of themselves, their inner critic, as its own creative dance that you can dictate and be in control of in your own creative process. Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I hope the next time you're in your studio and you catch yourself beginning to spiral or catastrophize over a mistake, whether it's a brush mark that's off, whether it's a whole painting that can't gel, or even a body of work, that the minute you start to have that not again moment, you're able to invite the humor in of assuming that you could make art without making missteps and mistakes and messes. And on that note, I am going to shamelessly plug, I have 4 spots left in my Spain retreat. You guys, these are once in a lifetime experiences. In fact, the crew who went with me in Morocco last summer is meeting up again. They're doing putting their own self-funded, self-guided retreat together in the desert in Arizona. I won't be able to make it because I'm up to my eyeballs in work, but let's just say that these experiences are truly so formative. You find your creative community, you find like-minded people. We have some of the best conversations. You'll walk away with skills and insights and best friends. And I really can't impress enough how wonderful these are. I would not be pushing them so hard if I didn't know that they change people's lives. So make sure to grab those last spots. We're going to be going the last week of September into October. You are welcome to reach out to me if you have any really specific questions. I will email you back. We'll even hop on a Zoom call if that feels more comfortable to you. With that, I'm going to leave you. Thank you so much for listening. And yeah, happy painting. Thank you so much for listening and thank you for being here. I wanted to also encourage you guys to leave a review. The feedback is incredibly helpful. And if you leave a review, I will read your handle or your name on the following week's episode. Take care, y'all, and happy creating.